The city of Caesarea was for nearly three centuries the Roman capital of the empire's province of Palestine. The city of Sardis was for many, many centuries the greatest commercial center in Asia Minor. Rhodes, the great harbor of the island of Rhodes, was the busiest maritime city for half a millennium of the entire eastern Mediterranean. The giant colossus that bestrode its harbor was a symbol of its power and importance. Caesarea, Sardis, Rhodes are today empty ruins, places visited only by inquisitive tourists. Which is to say that the question, does a particular city have a future, is more than a frivolous inquiry. Cities, like human beings, have lifespans, longer or shorter. They are born, they have periods of growth and health and strength and maturity, and then they wither away. Some are cut short. Does Cleveland have a future? The city of Caesarea was built by the Romans to be a particular type of city, their city. They didn't want the Roman emperor or the Roman governor of the province to be jostled about or to be badly used by the Judean mobs. The Jews were always restive under the iron boot of Rome. You know of the two great bloody rebellions in the first and second century which they waged. But even before this, our proud people, freedom-loving, was unwilling to accept the dictation of another tyranny. And Caesarea was built to protect the provincial governor, procurator, from the attitudes, the mobs, the shouts, the demonstrations, the confrontations of a Judean mob. When the Romans were no longer able to manage the effective control of Asia Minor, Caesarea lost any purpose for being and simply withers and disappears from history. The city of Newport in Rhode Island was once a greater port city and a busier place than New York City. The great shipping lanes of the Atlantic in the early 18th century met there. Goods could be transshipped from the ocean boats to the small towns of New England, which was then the commercial mercantile center of the United States. But as this country developed and the people pushed westward, Newport was no longer as convenient a place to unload goods. New York was further to the west. New York stood at the mouth of the great river system which gave to the heartlands of America. And New York took over. And Newport has remained ever since a small town with a colonial atmosphere. Nothing more. There's an old rabbinic adage to the effect, Im ein kemach, ein Torah. And if there is no worldly occupation, the Talmudic word, interesting, is literally bread. If there is no bread, there is no capacity for culture, for learning, for the things of the mind. A community must produce wealth, a surplus, for there to be the free time, the opportunity to provide for the schooling and the debate and the discussion, which is the very beginning and nexus of any cultural life. A community will have a cultural atmosphere about it if it is a productive community. People will come there. Ideas will be brought there with the goods that come. But once a city ceases to be economically viable, people will leave, goods will cease to come in, and you will have simply a few squatting people instead of a city which is vibrant, which is giving off its own civilization, which means simply the culture of a city. Now, our city, Cleveland, grew into prominence because it lay at the very center of the development of what we might call the iron and steel age of America. We were conveniently located. The ships could bring down the iron ore from Lake Superior, from the Great Mesabi Range. The trains could bring in the limestone from the quarries of Indiana and the soft coal from the pits of West Virginia and of Pennsylvania. And the roads and the trains could bring in cheap labor from the communities and the farms of Central and Eastern Europe. And here, with cheap labor, with new machinery at the lowest possible cost, one could pour the steel and forge the steel into machine tools and use these machine tools to create the goods which America exulted in its frontier, the frontier of land, the frontier of industry, was using to build our incredible prosperity. From 1880 to 1930, Cleveland was the fastest growing city in the United States. We were a city based upon brawn rather than upon brain, upon the production of metal and metallic products, the kinds of things that made for the roads of the railroads, for the great heavy machinery which was used to conquer and then to destroy the beauties of this continent. Cleveland was a prosperous town, proud of itself, confident, exultant. And then there came a new age to these United States. The age of iron and steel gave way to the age of electronics, the age of space. Now we were not dealing so much with raw material forged into simple tools. We were dealing with the minds of men using their highly critical and research facilities to discover new ways to increase the productive capacity, the reach of American prosperity. And Cleveland was ill-suited to this new age. We had never built here an infrastructure of ideas, of people who had ideas. This was a town of factory hands and factory managers. And our universities were almost all undergraduate-oriented. There were a few research facilities here, and these attitudes persist. In Boston in the early 1950s, immediately upon realizing the nature of this new age, industry, city built all around the town in that great Route 128, a series of research facilities closely attached to the great research universities. We managed in the very end of the 1960s to build two big research buildings near Case Institute of Technology, and one of those lies empty to this very moment. We were a city of brawn, not of brains. And the problem lay not so much with any incompetence or ill will among the city fathers. Very little that could have been done by a more competent mayor here or there, a more energetic councilman here or then, could have been done, because Cleveland's fate was shared by all of the communities of this Great Lakes area. Our failing lies rather, if failing it be, at the hands of those who owned the factories and owned the industries of the city. They were so powerful. They were so certain of themselves. The raw material, the steel, and the tools which they produced were so essential to American industry that they invested little, if anything, in research and in development. The iron and steel industry has traditionally been the industry which made the least commitment of its profit to its future. And as a result, there were few new products, and new ideas, and the intelligent men who could develop these new ideas went elsewhere, where the climate was better, where the environments were more agreeable, where the recreational facilities were more available, where the friendship of others of similar interest was more easily to come by. The South grew, the Southwest grew, the coast grew apace, but a town like Cleveland remained relatively static. Oh, we grew in real numbers, but not in terms of relative numbers. When I was in school here in Cleveland, Cleveland was the sixth largest population center in the United States. Today, Greater Cleveland is the 12th or 13th largest population center in the United States. Obviously, the times passed us by. We were not part of the cutting edge of the new age. And we did not have any particular or unique special competence which would have given us a community with a special use to the society. Washington is not a great industrial center, but it's the political heart of the nation. The boroughs of Manhattan are not great production centers, but they are the fiscal and the entertainment capitals of the nation. Boston has great industry, and of course, but it also has a particular destiny as one of the great intellectual and research centers of the United States. And Cleveland? Cleveland is just today another great big town. We have industry, we have service industry, we have shops, we have hospitals and schools, all the things that 2 million people require. But there's nothing unique, nothing special about our present, and there will be nothing unique and nothing special about our future. We're a second-level community, a second-tier city, and that, I think, will remain. And I find nothing inherently sad about this destiny, this future for our city. There's nothing wrong in not living in the greatest population center of the nation. We all enjoy visiting New York City. We all enjoy going to Lincoln Center. We all enjoy going to theater and to the great museums. But if we lived in New York City, how much time would we spend in the course of a year in the museums and in Lincoln Center and at theater? And how much time would we spend in the crowded, steamy subways? And how much time would we be spending on the dirty and sometimes dangerous streets? Cleveland's a second-level town, and I think it's time that all of us got over what I would call the boosterism of Cleveland. Greatest, the best location in the nation. We never were, we'll never be. And I find nothing inherently wrong in that simple statement of fact. Because the best location in the nation was simply a public relations campaign managed by utilities designed to convince industries that it was cheaper to build plant here than any place else. There was cheaper labor, there were cheaper taxes, there was an easier city government to deal with. And those aren't the terms in which one will determine whether a city has an agreeable, amenable environment in which to live and to raise a family, to do the things that human beings require. America has a strange blindness about its cities. It assumes that every city must be memorable and must be monumental. We judge our cities by how many layers of steel we can raise one upon another in the downtown area, layers of steel which are empty all but 8 or 10 working hours of the day. We judge the importance of our cities by how many miles of concrete ribbon highways are thrown through its neighborhoods, destroying the neighborhoods, so that workers can get from the outlying farms, which are heavily mortgaged as split-level homes, down to the businesses in the core of the city. And that's not the judgment of a city. A city is a place for people to live in, to find agreeable, to find manageable, to find helpful and encouraging in their lives. Seems to me that Cleveland ought to stop trying to be New York and stop trying to be Chicago and stop trying to be Dallas or San Francisco or Los Angeles and just learn to be something which would be unique among all American cities, an attractive place in which to live. But that's, after all, what cities are all about, a place for people to live in. And that's not what American cities manage to effect. Now, what kind of future do we really face? What's ahead of us? I think when we face this new future, we all ought to recognize that as the space age electronic revolution has taken place in industry, a similar revolution of communication and transportation has taken place as far as our living in a city is concerned. Why do all of us instinctively compare Cleveland to the model of a great big metropolitan community? Because we were brought up in an atmosphere which associated the small town with parochialism, with being narrow. The small town person was a hick, a rube, a person who was not cultured, who was not civilized, who did not have the advantages of the city. And two or three generations ago, this was in fact true. I live in Cleveland, a small town. I read daily a newspaper from New York. My world, this world inside of me, is not limited by Cleveland. The news magazines that I read are published elsewhere and they deal with the problems of the world. I turn on my radio, my television, and I hear network news. I see network theater produced for me in London or New York or in Los Angeles. I go constantly about this country speaking and being spoken to. Any number of my professional friendships and my personal friendships exist outside of the neighborhood in which I live. They routinely travel and visit me. I routinely travel and go to them. The standards of my profession are set by groups of us meeting outside of Cleveland, not simply within the city. And that's true of each and every one of us. Any number of the men who have studied the city have commented on what they call the unhinging of civilization from the city. The fact that you can have community without propinquity. Or what's one man called, that we live in a post-city age. It's now possible for news commentators, for the great writers of our country, the artists, many of us who create the culture, which is America, to live in the hills of Vermont or on the shores of Carolina or in the empty desert spaces of New Mexico and Arizona, and still be every day part of the throb, of the beat of American life. Because now our culture is no longer the culture of our place, but it's the culture which comes to us by long-distance telephone, by the radio, by the television, by letter, by travel. We are part of the larger world wherever we live. And the question as to where we live is not a question, therefore, of ultimate significance in our lives, provided that a number of services performed for us and for our families are available to us in the city where we choose to live. We need adequate housing. We need certain kinds of safety and protection. We need a sense of a community where people of all kinds meet and mingle and interchange ideas. We need first-rate schools. We need recreational opportunity of quality. We need these kinds of things of our city. This the cities must provide. So the question today is not, does Cleveland have a great symphony opera hall? But does Cleveland have adequate health, medical, welfare, recreational facilities? The things that make it possible for human beings to exist at their most basic. There we must answer, not yet. There we must say that the future of Cleveland is not yet certain. Because Cleveland still seems determined to judge itself by how many layers of steel there are down in Erieview, rather than how much rat control there is in Huff, how many decent houses have been built, how much better our school curriculum is, how much lower the pupil-teacher ratio in a class may be, how much more available quality medical care may be. These are the true standards of life in a city. These are not yet the standards by which we judge our city. A retired mayor, before leaving office, published a glossy brochure describing what he called the Stokes years. In the introductory letter to this brochure, Mayor Stokes said that he ran for office originally in order to make it possible for the city to become responsive to the needs of its citizens. And that, I think, is the ultimate responsibility of any public official today. Not to build great monuments, not necessarily to build more highways, but to find out what it is that we need, we and every other citizen of this community needs, in order to live with some degree of agreeableness, and to find ways to make this available to us. And Mayor Stokes and his dears at office did do any number of things, particularly in the heart of the city, to raise the amenity of life there. But I noticed that even in this brochure, by a man who said he was designated to be responsive to the needs of the community, the four central pages are filled with details of monuments, pictures of building, the mayor in the great steel hat of a construction engineer, cutting ribbon, putting the first spade in the ground for this Erie View project or for that. Now, buildings will come, obviously. Population grows, buildings become obsolete, new needs arise. But that's not really what a city is all about today. A city must be a city where people can live together, work together, find together the means to build the quality services on which all of our lives depend. Well, today we have a new mayor. And Mayor Perk was elected because he was responsive to the needs of at least half of the city citizens, those who are white and particularly those who live on the west side. I hope that he recognizes that he must be responsive to the needs of all of the city, and that all of us have the same needs for health, for protection, for justice, for amenity of life, for outreach, for quality education. There's nothing racial or religious or neighborhood about these needs. And we have to begin to make the judgments about our city and about its needs in terms of people. That's the future. And those are the battles which Mayor Stokes lost during the last years of his office. The battle to take poverty out of one area and see if it couldn't be solved by putting public housing in all areas. The battle to see that highways are not simply for the convenience of those in the suburbs who need for reasons to come into the center of the city, with utter disrespect for the neighborhoods, the housing through which it runs. To see that people rather than cement, people rather than steel are the ultimate judge of policy, the ultimate basis of priority of decision making. Cleveland, they say, is a town which has a diversified economic base, the kind of base which means that when the economy is prosperous, we are somewhat prosperous. When the economy is depressed, we are somewhat depressed. We have a varied base. We have a stable economic base. There's every reason to be confident that for the 2 million people who live here in this community, there is enough for us to create an agreeable, just, and amenable life. If we do not try to ape every other city, if we restrain our urge to build monuments, find ways of building decent men and women, decent people. If we recognize that the needs of the 1970s for us are human-based, must be human-oriented. We need a society which can talk together, where the river is a waterway and not a racial barrier. We need a city where justice is not simply punitive, means economic justice for all. A city where our young can go to school and be enlightened, have lights turned on for them and not opportunity turned off. A city where the air that we breathe will be clean air, not soot that coats our lungs. Cities in the next generation must exist for their people. Cities in past generations have existed for their industry, for the economy, purely for that. Everything has been ancillary to it. Our lakes are filthy because we didn't care what industry did as long as industry produced a profit. And our air is filthy for the same reasons. And our housing is shoddy. And our schools are overcrowded because in the 1930s and 40s, particularly in the 40s and early 50s, we didn't ask industry to provide housing for its workers or to guarantee them adequate wages. We simply said, you want to expand? Let everyone come. Now cities must be for people. We're going to pay a price for the inadequacy of policy, the short-sightedness of policy in the past. And we can pay the price. Cleveland is still a wealthy town. We can pay the price if we are willing to forget and forego the great public monuments. If we don't judge Cleveland like all Clevelanders do, my God, but the downtown is dead after 5 o'clock at night. Or, my God, Cleveland's skyscrapers are puny compared to the skyscrapers of any other city. Who cares? Who really cares? The question is, what kind of city do we live in 24 hours a day? What kind of air do we breathe 24 hours a day? What kind of education are our children receiving 8 hours a day? What kind of playgrounds can our children play in 8 hours a day? What kind of food can we buy in our stores with what kind of policing so that the food which we eat is clean and appropriate and processed correctly? All these things are the ultimate questions which we face. And they're the judgments which will determine whether Cleveland has simply years or a future. What will the answer be? Amen.